You're listening to HuntertonChamberRadio.com, sponsored by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. Our studios are located in the CenturyLink building at 14 Mine Street, Flemington, New Jersey. The content and views of our hosts do not necessarily reflect the views of the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. To contact our station, call 908-782-7115 or email onair@hunterdon-chamber.org. Thank you to our sponsors and underwriters. Please remember to support them and buy Hunterdon, buy local. Visit www.hunterdonchamberradio.com for a complete listing of our programming.
Grants for Head Start programs. The president of the NAACP in Spokane has resigned amid questions about whether she lied about her racial identity. The parents of Rachel Dolezal have said she has falsely portrayed herself as black for years, even though she's actually white. Chapter member Kitiera Johnson, who led the petition asking for Dolezal's resignation, says she should be forgiven, but she shouldn't be head of the NAACP there.
We don't care what color she is. That doesn't matter. But what does matter is the type of leader that you are. Integrity does matter.
Dolezal has been a longtime figure in Spokane's human rights community and teaches African studies to college students. This is USA Headline News.
Individuals and businesses with tax problems, listen carefully. If you owe over $10,000 in back taxes or have unfiled tax returns, U.S. Tax Shield can help you take back control. The IRS can seize your bank accounts, garnish your paycheck, close your business, and file criminal charges. Our team of tax attorneys can stop collections and get you protected. U.S. Tax Shield offers a price protection guaranteed quote to get you protected today. U.S. Tax Shield is A-plus rated with the BBB, so call 800-479-2697. U.S. Tax Shield, 800-479-2697.
The Supreme Court won't review an abortion case from North Carolina involving ultrasounds. AP correspondent Jerry Bodlander reports.
The High Court has left in place a federal appeals court decision that struck down a North Carolina law. It had required abortion providers to display and describe an ultrasound to the pregnant woman before she had an abortion. The federal appeals court found the 2011 law requiring the so-called narrated ultrasound was ideological in intent and violated doctors' free speech rights. Reproductive rights groups praised the High Court, saying it is keeping politics out of the exam room. Jerry Bodlander, Washington.
Military officials say two people are hospitalized after gunfire broke out at an entrance to the Little Rock Air Force Base in Arkansas. They say the shots were fired when a civilian tried to enter the base. Police say the would-be intruder was injured and taken into custody. The base was placed on lockdown. Another juror in the Colorado Theater shooting trial has been dismissed. The judge today granted a defense motion to dismiss a woman whose brother-in-law was shot in an armed robbery in Denver last week. Three other jurors were released last week over concerns they were exposed to media reports and may not have been truthful about it. 20 jurors and alternates are left to decide the fate of James Holmes. Amnesty International says world leaders have abandoned millions of refugees and left them to die by failing to provide basic human protections. They are urging world leaders to overhaul refugee policies. I'm Kelly Sloan, and you're listening to USA Headline News.
And the weather today, chance of showers and thunderstorms this afternoon, mostly cloudy with a high near 85. West winds around 6 miles an hour. The chance of precipitation is about 50%. And the new rainfall amounts of less than a tenth of an inch, except higher amounts possible during the thunderstorms. Tonight, there's a chance of showers and thunderstorms, mainly before midnight. And it'll be mostly cloudy with a low around 71. Southwest winds around 5 miles an hour, becoming calm in the evening. And a chance of precipitation tonight is 40%. Tuesday, chance of showers and thunderstorms, mainly afternoon. Some of the storms could produce gusty winds and heavy rain. It'll be mostly cloudy with a high near 88. Southwest winds 3 to 7 miles an hour. And the chance of precipitation is 50%. Tuesday night, it'll be mostly cloudy, then gradually becoming clear with a low around 63. North winds 3 to 5 miles an hour, and Wednesday should be sunny with a high near 83. And Wednesday night, there'll be a chance of showers. You're listening to Mental Health Matters, and I'm Larry Cartwright, your host. And this is NAMI's Hour, compliments of the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. And NAMI is the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And in Jersey, there's a chapter of NAMI in every county in the state, every state in the union, and overseas. In Hunterdon County, we are all volunteers. We have no paid staff. We work out of our homes, use our own phones, etc. and we try to help people and families who may have someone in their family who has a mental health issue, or someone themselves who has a mental health issue and is trying to get through their, you know, on with their life. We do this by teaching classes. We have a family-to-family class for families who have someone in their family who is 18 and above who has a mental health issue. We run support groups, places where people can come and accept it, be accepted and not judged. And everybody in our support group has either been there, done that, or is still going through it. So nobody judges anybody. And we do a basics class for, that's about 7 weeks, for families who have children, 17 and younger, who are suffering from ADHD or anxiety or whatever. And I have to say, all our classes are free. We don't charge for anything. Books, pamphlets, everything is free. And so it's, if you know someone and would need someone to reach out to, you can call our number. It is 908-284-0500. And you won't get a live person, but we do check the phone every day. So within 10 to 12 hours, you'll get a call back. We are very privileged today to have with us Dr. Marla Deibler. And she is a licensed clinical psychologist, and she's the founder and executive director of the Center for Emotional Health of Greater Philadelphia in Cherry Hill and also in Princeton, New Jersey. Dr. Deibler has been on Dr. Oz and AE, Hoarders, CBS, ABC, Fox News, and she's had articles in New York Times and other major newspapers, and she's been on this show before. Doctor, are you there?
I am.
Okay, very good. I'm glad. I'm glad I didn't hit the wrong button and disconnect you. Doctor, you and your organization and people that you work with, you specialize in like anxiety disorders, obsessive compulsive disorder, and a number of related disorders. Could you sort of like take us through these disorders and the symptoms?
Sure. So we specialize in two different families of disorders for the most part. There are the anxiety disorders family, which include disorders like generalized anxiety disorder, which is very common. That is essentially worries and rumination about numerous areas of your life that you find difficult to control and that negatively impact your daily functioning and cause clinically significant distress. Then there are other disorders like panic disorder, which is characterized by recurrent panic attacks and anticipation, anxiety about the anticipation of having future panic attacks, and agoraphobia, which is sometimes related to that, which is essentially anxiety about open spaces. So oftentimes people with panic disorder, for example, have difficulty out in open spaces where getting assistance or escape would be difficult. So, for example, waiting in a grocery line might be particularly stressful and may bring on a lot of anxiety or possibly a panic attack. So anxiety disorders like those, for example, and then the obsessive compulsive and related disorders, which include things like obsessive compulsive disorder or OCD, which is characterized by obsessions and compulsions, to habit disorders like trichotillomania, which is a hair pulling disorder, and excoriation disorder, which is a skin-picking disorder, as well as body dysmorphic disorder, which is a hyperfocus on part of the body that seems to be defective or problematic in some way to the point where it causes extreme distress and impairment in one's life.
But is it defective in their point of view or in general? In other words, if they look at a mirror,
it's a distorted perception, right, of their body. So,
okay,
for example,
right,
they may feel that they are horrendous looking because their nose is crooked.
Mm-hmm.
And for the most part, other people don't really see it.
Right.
It seems within normal
right.
range.
You know what I found very interesting? Not too long ago, I found out that Thomas Jefferson had, how do you say it, agoraphobia? The fear
agoraphobia.
Of, yeah, fear of going into a room with a lot of people and... which I find was amazing since he was president. But also I found out that when he was help writing the Declaration of Independence, he would get a hold of Ben Franklin and meet Franklin on a corner, hand him the papers. And Jefferson would go back to his where he was writing in his room or whatever, and Franklin would take it to the committee. And I thought that was very interesting, and that's something that I learned up in Philadelphia when we went on a little tour up there. But he could stand on a balcony and talk to 3,000 people, but he'd have trouble going in a room with 10, you know, which I found very interesting, you know.
That is interesting, yeah. I mean, that could be certainly a number of things. It could be agoraphobia, it could be social phobia, could be claustrophobia, hard to say. But definitely it sounds like some anxiety there.
Right, definitely. And, you know, and they said that, you know, that he had this. And so it wasn't something that, you know, somebody just made up. It was actually there when you were going through, you know, the area and, you know, so on and so forth. So it was, I found that very interesting. But then again, if you look, we do some presentations pretty much monthly for Educational Services Commission. And when we put a screen, we have a PowerPoint, and we put a screen on the wall of, you know, all these famous people who in some way or other had mental health issues. Yes, there's a lot of musicians. Yes, there's a lot of actresses and so on and so forth. But to see that, you know, like Buzz Aldrin, walked on the moon, suffers from severe depression, you know. Things like that just amaze me, you know, that somebody that could do these things that they've done in their life and achieve in their life and still, you know, have a problem, you know. And there's a lot of presidents on there too, you know. So just thought
Absolutely.
I'd throw that out.
Because you struggle with a mental health issue doesn't mean that you're not capable of great things. Certainly.
No, right, exactly. I know that you have been on A&E Hoarder Show. Has hoarding always been a disorder, or has it been recently added due to TV shows and publicity it's been receiving?
Yeah, hoarding has kind of come into its own in recent years. I'm sure part of that is due to the media's attention to it. But in terms of treatment and being able to access treatment, I think that's been a really beneficial thing. Hoarding disorder became a legitimate disorder with a name last year with the publication of the DSM-5, which is our diagnostic
right.
manual for mental health,
which
came
is about
out last
2 foot
May,
thick.
More than a year ago now. Prior to that, it was mentioned as a possible symptom of obsessive compulsive personality disorder. It's sort of just a byline and afterthought kind of a thing, but it really does seem to be its own distinct disorder that requires very specific treatment, different way of addressing it than you would those other problems.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I've noticed, I looked at the DM5 and couldn't believe how thick it was. You know, and like, gee, really? You know, it'd take me 6 months to read this, you know. And probably wouldn't understand
yeah.
half of it, you know.
That's actually been kind of a criticism of it, in that each volume it sort of grows and grows and grows. But I think that really just speaks to the need for more mental health research and more effort to understanding these different struggles that people have so that we can better characterize it and better distinguish them so that we can develop more and more effective treatments.
Right. I agree. I agree 100%. The repetitive behaviors, I have trouble pronouncing it, so I'll just call hair pulling, nail biting, skin picking. Is this done? Well, let me ask you, for what reason do the people do these things? Is it a various reason?
It's really different for everyone
right,
in
okay.
terms of the function of the behavior. They are compulsive disorders in that people feel an urge to engage in the behavior, and they have a difficult time stopping the behavior. They don't experience it as painful. It's not intentionally destructive or self-injurious. They're just sort of habits gone awry, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
However, they're habits that have gone awry that people generally really want to stop because they don't like the long-term negative consequences like the hair loss or the skin damage or
right.
the skin infections. But it's very difficult to stop it because they are pleasurable in some way, at least at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Would cutting fall within that spectrum?
Cutting doesn't. No, cutting is actually a self-injurious behavior that is really considered very different. People usually engage in cutting because they feel overwhelmed but numb, and cutting is a way for them to experience pain, which is something that they describe as sort of being a release because it helps sort of break that numbness.
Right.
But these other habit behaviors like hair pulling and skin picking, they're really not experienced that way. They're experienced as feeling good or feeling like a little bit of a relief from tension or stress or anxiety, and it really isn't experienced in the same way, and it isn't treated the same way either.
Okay.
Really.
Okay. I used to work up until recently part-time, one day a week at the hospital, and they required me to go into the well, they call it too central, but it's like a lockup ward, and talk to the patients. And since my son, my youngest son, we have four children, and I believe I mentioned before one time that my youngest son is paranoid schizophrenia, and, you know, he was hospitalized for almost 3 years at one point continuously, and in and out of the hospital numerous times after that. So they felt that if I would go talk to the people, the patients, that it was more, you know, coming from someone who was there, you know, had lived it, you know, as a parent. And one day I remember distinctly this young man says to me, "Can I speak to you after, you know, it's over?" I said, "Sure." You know, so we went outside into the big room, and we were talking, and all of a sudden he says, "I got to show you something." And he pulls up his sleeve up above the elbow on both sides. "Doctor, there wasn't a minute piece of skin that wasn't cut on both arms." And I was like, I was flabbergasted. I was like, I couldn't even speak for a second, you know. And he said that the pain in his head was so bad that it was easier to feel the pain on his arms. I don't know if that made a lot of sense or not, but I know his arms had scars from his wrist all the way up to his, you know, above his elbows on both arms, and, you know, inside about the back, it was just covered. There wasn't a fraction of a space on his arm that wasn't cut, and it just shocked me. It really did. You know, have you ever seen anything like that?
Yeah, that's a really great description, actually, of what cutting behavior and self-injurious behaviors are like. I have some experience with that, but it's really outside of my area of expertise.
It was outside of mine, too.
I mean, hair pulling. You know. Although at times, I mean, people have definitely likened the two together. They're really very different in that oftentimes people are not in any pain or any discomfort. They're not depressed, they're not overwhelmed, they have anxious temperaments,
mm-hmm.
and it's sort of like a grooming behavior gone awry, if that makes sense.
Right. No, yeah. I was flabbergasted because I've seen people through being with NAMI for the last almost 17 years that, you know, they had loved ones who cut themselves and such, but it wasn't anything like this, you know. I mean, it was just beyond description to me, you know. So anyway,
it's a really great illustration of human suffering, you know. People
yes.
can really
yeah.
be suffering so much,
and you know, it's just, I suggested a few things, and I let the people in power know there that in the room there, the lockup place there, that, you know, maybe what they should do and so on and so forth, because I'm not sure if they were aware of that he had these, you know. But anyway, it's just, you know.
There's a very nice comprehensive kind of treatment for the problems that are associated with self-injurious behavior. It's called dialectical behavior therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great way to teach people to problem solve and to modulate their emotional experience in a more adaptive way than resorting to that.
Yeah, exactly. Would you think that all these are stress relievers, or they're a sign of a deeper disorder? or does it vary?
The behavior, the habit behaviors,
yeah,
or
like
self-injurious behavior?
All of the what we've been discussing.
I think it really depends. It depends on each individual and, you know, the function of the behavior. For example, to take it into a completely non-pathological example,
mm-hmm.
You see a child having a tantrum in a store. There's a lot of different reasons why that child might be having a tantrum. They might be upset with their mother. They might really want a toy they can't have. They might be just tired and cranky. They might be hungry. There are lots of reasons a child might be having a tantrum. And
right.
The same thing with psychopathology. There's a lot of different reasons people develop psychopathology. There are a lot of different reasons psychopathology is exacerbated and maintained, and it really depends. That's one of the most complicated things about trying to learn to understand mental health problems is that there are so many different factors
exactly.
that go into people's psyches and, you know, how we work. We're really very complicated beings, and the brain is really, you know, one of the most complicated parts of our bodies.
Sure, sure. And, you know, it's people say to me all the time, well, everybody has anxiety. Everybody gets anxious about something. Everybody gets depressed. And yeah, they do. I mean, you know, you break up with your girlfriend or you lose your job or whatever the case may be. You crack up your favorite car, you know, et cetera. Yeah, you could get depressed. Absolutely. Yes, you could have anxiety. Guaranteed. But what I say to them, and I'm no professional like you, but what I say to them is, yeah, people get depressed, and it may last for a day or two or three, but then they get out of it. You know, I know that I had a problem with my job at one point, and I was sitting there, and I was becoming depressed. But then I got to thinking after 3 days, I got 4 kids. I got a mortgage. I got car payments. I got to get a job, you know. So away went the depression, and I went out looking for a job. And it's the same thing, I think, with like anxiety. People get anxious. We're going to go on a first date or, you know, whatever the case may be. But it depends, I think, on the length of time that it carries on. I think it has something to do with it. Do you agree? Hopefully.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's not only the duration, but the severity and the character of it, too. I mean, you're right. Everybody does feel depressed from time to time. Everybody feels anxious.
Sure.
There is a very wide range of human experience, including emotion. But when that becomes, outside of that normal range to the extent that it's difficult to cope with,
mm-hmm.
and it starts impairing your life, that's when it becomes a problem. Whether
right.
it's a behavior or an emotion or a thought process, you know, if it becomes problematic in that way and it's no longer... you're no longer able to function on a daily basis like you normally would, well, then that becomes a problem.
Right, exactly. I just thought of something. Does Tourette's or tic disorder, does that fall in any of these categories?
That's a really great question. We really don't know. The research on this stuff is pretty new in terms of brain structure and function. It is related. It's more like a cousin than it is a sibling, if that makes any sense.
Sure.
We know
yeah.
that, for example, when you look at imaging studies of OCD and hair pulling versus tic disorders, they look very similar. And it sort of looks like hair pulling, for example, might be sort of like a tic. Especially when you compare it to the brains of other kinds of psychopathology, but it's not exactly the same. It doesn't respond exactly the same way to treatment. It doesn't seem quite as neurologically based in the same way, but it certainly shares some brain structural similarities in terms of what's going awry.
Right.
But that's still so new in terms of the research. It's still very much in its infancy.
And not being a professional, it just seems to me that the research into any of these disorders has got to be so challenging. Like you said before, the brain is an organ, but it is so intensive and, you know, could fall into different categories. And, you know, I think a lot of times, like when they're trying to diagnose someone with a mental health issue, that some of the symptoms so overlap that they may say, oh, well, that's bipolar or schizoaffective or whatever. But it's like then they come up with a different one because, you know what I'm saying? It's like it's so tough to distinguish between some of them because the symptoms overlap so.
It is. You know, I think we're at a crossroads right now in terms of the future of mental health research. Historically, we've diagnosed mental health problems through essentially self-report and observation by observable symptoms. So, you know, asking someone if their appetite's been affected, if their sleep has been affected, how their mood is, things
right.
like this, sort
right.
of like a little checklist of symptoms that fall together in particular ways that we then call a particular disorder. However, just in recent years, the field has been saying, well, this doesn't really seem right. There's a ton of overlap between symptoms and different diagnoses and different categories. There's got to be a better way to do this. And so instead of looking at it categorically, the field, including National Institute of Mental Health, which just in the last year has said that they want to change the way they look at it too, and they're really starting to look at this in a more dimensional way.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, when mood regulation has gone awry, you know, what does that mean? And if we look at that in different ways other than self-reported mood disturbance, if we look at genetics, for example, if we look at brain imaging, if we look at hormonal and metabolic functions, do we notice any differences, and can we sort of identify different ways to perhaps diagnose, perhaps treat, but certainly describe these different syndromes that people experience
right.
might be onto some totally new and perhaps more effective way to look at, diagnose, and treat these problems.
Yeah, it's just so, you know, you just wish there could be an X-ray or a blood test in it, you know, to diagnose it. So, you know, but that's not going to happen in my lifetime anyway. So, you know, but it's just the progress that they have made is astounding. But there's still such a long way to go yet, you know. But we're getting there step by step. We have to take a quick break. You're listening to Mental Health Matters, and we will be right back after a commercial or two.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterdon at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterdon, the voice for mental health in Hunterdon County.
Rab Coins of Flemington, New Jersey has been in business for over 37 years. We are highly competitive buyers of gold, silver, and platinum coins, jewelry, and scrap metals, and have recently been named the exclusive gold buyer for Diamond Nation and HealthQuest. We also provide professional appraisal, sales, and liquidation services for individuals, law firms, estate trustees, and bank trust departments in New Jersey and Philadelphia. Products and services include gold and silver, American and foreign coins, certified rare date and modern coins, numismatic supplies and books, gold, silver, and platinum bullion, paper currency, United States proof, and mint sets, including current issues. From junior collector to the experienced investor, Rab Coins has been for numismatists since 1974. Founder and owner, Randy Block, an expert numismatist, has been an active member of the coin industry for over 45 years. Visit us at 56 Main Street in historic downtown Flemington or call toll-free 1-800-819-9875.
Hey, this is Big C of Good Morning Hunterdon on HuntingChamberRadio.com. Like what you hear on Hunterdon Chamber Radio? Now you can take it with you. Download our Hunterdon Chamber Radio app from iTunes and Google Play Store now. Get schedules, station information, listen live, or to the latest podcasts. Everything in the palm of your hand or in your car during your commute. Get the HuntingChamberRadio.com app today.
Welcome back to Mental Health Matters. I'm your host, Larry Cartwright, and we are very privileged, and I mean that sincerely, to have Dr. Marla Deibler with us. She's a licensed clinical psychologist, and she's the founder and executive director of the Center for Emotional Health of Greater Philadelphia, which is in Cherry Hill, and is also an office in Princeton. Dr. Deibler, we were speaking, before about, disorders and so on and so forth. Now, cognitive behavior therapy. Now, I've heard of it. I, have somewhat of an idea. Could you explain what it's used for?
Sure. Cognitive behavioral therapy is essentially the most evidence-based set of treatments that we have. And what they do is they focus on the relationship between cognitions, which are thoughts, behaviors, and emotions. And essentially what we help people do is to change the way they think in order to affect their emotional experience and to change their behaviors so that these three main components work in a more adaptive way. There are cognitive behavioral treatments that have been shown through research to be effective for a wide range of disorders, and especially the ones that we've been talking about today.
Oh, okay. What is... I've never heard of it. Exposure and response prevention? And what is it, and who would be a candidate for it?
So exposure and response prevention is the evidence-based treatment for obsessive-compulsive disorder. It is a kind of cognitive behavioral therapy. It's a specific kind of cognitive behavioral therapy that essentially looks at... understanding OCD and its treatment from a very behavioral perspective. So what you've probably, even though you might not have heard of exposure and response prevention, what you probably have heard is exposure therapy or graded exposure or systematic desensitization.
Okay.
And essentially what it is helping people to, in a very systematic way, face their fears so that they relearn that their response to the thing that makes them really anxious isn't really dangerous. So we expose them to the things that trigger their anxiety so that they are able to learn that their feared outcome doesn't occur and that these things that they feel are very dangerous are not actually dangerous.
That I'm just thinking, if you're afraid of something, whatever the case may be, let's just say you're afraid of going out in public or whatever. How would you would take the person out in public? Wouldn't that just cause a huge anxiety attack, for lack of a better word?
That's a good question. So taking people to the thing that makes them most fearful would, at one point, was referred to as flooding, which is essentially, we take this thing they're really scared of and we keep you in that situation until you just kind of get exhausted and you're no longer afraid of it. But most practitioners don't do that anymore. It's just very difficult to endure, and as you can imagine, nobody really looks forward to going through that treatment. And so,
yeah, really.
What people do now are different kinds of graded exposure therapies, where there is a hierarchy collaboratively constructed between therapist and the patient that helps people to very slowly and gradually expose them to things that make them anxious, but in a very graded way. So starting with something very mildly anxiety provoking, and once they're able to do that and that feels comfortable, then moving up the chain to more and more intensely anxiety provoking stimuli.
Okay. So it's like a step-by-step exposure.
Exactly.
Okay. Because I was just thinking, you're going to take someone that's, got a real big anxiety over, I don't know, having the light on and looking in the mirror, and are you going to stick them in front of a mirror and say, here, look at it? You know, I think that, you know, my own non-professional mind is saying, wow, I don't know if I'd want to volunteer for that, you know? So, you know what I'm saying? It's just, you know, probably a bad example, but, you know, I just think, you know, because you want people to get help, you know, and I'm thinking, wow, you know, that's pretty, you know, traumatic the way you do it, you know, but now that you explained that,
but
it's actually not.
The way it's executed is not at all. We do it in a very gradual way and always with the consent of the patient. It's done very collaboratively. So, for example, if someone has trouble with crowds or being around unfamiliar people, the first thing that we might do is watch videos of crowds, just watching, you know, YouTube videos to see if that causes any anxiety and have them sort of work through that and experience that anxiety until it no longer seems very anxiety provoking anymore. And then we might move to sitting in a room with perhaps two other people with whom they're unfamiliar, like maybe two other therapists or something like that, but people who are unfamiliar to them and might cause a little anxiety because there are some strangers in the room. And once they get comfortable with that, we might have them, for example, walk into the store with one of us, therapists, and they might stand next to us while we buy a cup of coffee. But they're there, and they're present, and they're in that uncomfortable situation, even though they don't have to do anything. We might then move to them actually ordering the cup of coffee and paying for the cup of coffee.
Okay.
We might then move to, you know, them maybe going and having coffee by themselves in a coffee shop, ordering it, having it sitting there by themselves. And so it happens very gradually and in a way that they are able to manage.
Okay. Okay. I'm glad you explained it because it just, you know, I was saying, whoa, you know, that's, I don't know if I'd want to do that, you know, but I know that, you know, the success rate that, you know, organizations have, you know, how can I explain it? People ask me why I do what I do, you know, and I say, well, if I can help one family not go through the hell that I went through, you know, and my wife went through with our youngest son, then it's all worthwhile, you know, and I would assume that you look the same way. If you can help someone get through their whatever it is that they have, the problem they have, the mental health problem that they have, you know, it's a good day, you know. Isn't that true?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's certainly why I get out of bed in the morning.
Sure.
I really love I love seeing the progress that people make and you know, the joy that they can experience in life once they're past all the distress that they were feeling when they first came in. It's really great to see that. And that's actually one thing I really like about cognitive behavioral therapy in particular is it's a brief form of treatment. It's not like, you know, you'll be in therapy for 4 years and then we'll see how you are.
Right.
It's meant to be a short-term, present-focused, very active process that helps people work on their current symptoms so that they can get back to their lives.
Right. And I just want to add that, you know, I gave a brief history of my son. Well, right now he has his own apartment. He religiously takes his medication. He volunteers one day a week at the hospital, and he works 3 days a week part-time at BJ's, and he's very happy with his job. And so, I mean, he's come so, so far, and it's just, you know, wonderful to see, you know. And I know other parents or families who have seen their loved one, you know, make these steps. It's just amazing. It really is, to think back of where he was when he attempted suicide twice and wound up hospitalized for almost 3 years as opposed to now, you know. So I would imagine that you see this transition in your patients also, and it's, you know, very rewarding.
Yeah, absolutely. It certainly is. To get people to function in their lives again is a very rewarding thing to see.
Right. You know, and even if they're not where their parents had envisioned them to be, you know, so what? You know, they're living their life, they're enjoying it, and it's a lot better than where they were, you know. So, you know, I just throw that out there.
Yeah, actually, that's a really great point, that sometimes, you know, it's very difficult to be a parent, and, you know, sometimes our children don't choose the path that we want them to choose, or, you know, they're just not going to have the lives that perhaps we envisioned for mm-hmm. them for one reason or another, but... Mm-hmm. But to be able to, you know, see them get on a path to a fulfilled life, whatever that is for them, is
right.
a joy.
Right, exactly. You know, my son will never go back to college. I mean, he, you know, that'll never happen. But that's fine. I don't have a problem with that, you know. And if he continues to work at BJ's, then that's okay, too, you know, because he's happy and he's doing well and he's pretty much self-sufficient. You know, he knows, you know, who to call if he has a problem with this or that, and he knows how to get his medicines refilled and all that. So, you know, what else can you ask for, you know, at this point, you know?
Absolutely.
Habit reversal training. Would you explain that a little bit?
Sure. So habit reversal training is another kind of cognitive behavioral therapy. It mostly relies on behaviorism, once again, that helps people to change behaviors, essentially, that are unwanted. So oftentimes we use habit reversal training for trichotillomania or excoriation disorder or nail biting, those kinds of behaviors. But then we also use habit reversal training for things like tic disorders and Tourette's. We have a different name for it, but it is habit reversal training. We call it CBIT, Cognitive Behavioral Intervention for Tics, and that is essentially habit reversal training. It basically helps people to learn how to identify the sequence of events that leads to a particular behavior, to learn what makes a behavior more likely, what makes it less likely, and then make modifications to minimize the occurrence of that unwanted behavior, as well as minimize the consequences of it.
Right. Okay. That's interesting. You know, I had never heard of, you know, habit reversal training. And, you know, I just think your description of it is, you know, sounds awesome. Mindfulness training. What is that? That I haven't heard of.
Yeah. So mindfulness training has actually become a very popular sort of practice. In the context of therapy, it's considered among the practices in the newer cognitive behavioral therapies, and it essentially helps people to learn to be more present in the moment. A lot of times, particularly when we're experiencing a lot of distress, you know, our mind is in a lot of different places at once. We're not only trying to get through our day, but we're worried about what's happened in the past or what we're going to do in the future with a particular thing that's bothering us. And we're not really present in the moment. So what mindfulness training does is it helps us to learn to be more present in the moment, to be aware of all of our senses right here, right now, not thinking about anything in the past or the future, but just being fully present and aware. And it really can help with managing stress and anxiety and worry, rumination, things like that.
Okay, okay. That's very interesting. I just, you know, because, you know, when people meet all types of people, you know, and we do support groups and we teach classes and give presentations, you know, for NAMI and mental health issues and such. And, you know, a lot of times people will come up to us afterwards and, you know, ask about different things. You know, their relative has this or that or the other. And, you know, it's hearing these different therapies, for lack of a better word, you know, it's just interesting because that way, which is going to lead me to my next question, what is the process for someone who reaches out to your organization or has been referred to your organization and has one of the, you know, many disorders you cover? What is that? How does that process work?
So people find us in a lot of different ways. Some people get referred by their doctors. Some people find us through the internet because they're doing some research on a particular problem or a particular kind of therapy or resources in their area, and they contact us via the web, by email, or they can call us on the phone. And we have a central call center that they would speak with the office manager and tell her a little bit about what their needs are, and then we would try to find them one of our psychologists who would best fit their needs.
Okay. Is this done over the phone, or is it they then required to come in for an interview, or how does that work?
It could go either way. It depends on what their needs are. So a lot of times people will give just a little information about what they're looking for, and we can pretty easily see who would be a good fit for them. You know, we're a pretty specialized center. But sometimes, for example, parents will call up and say, you know, we've been to a few therapists before. We're not exactly sure what we want. We don't want to have to bring our child to a bunch of different appointments, but we would like to meet with someone and see what we think, to see if it's a good fit, to get their thoughts on what's going on with us.
Okay.
And then in that case, we would probably just make an appointment for them to speak with one of the people we think might be a good fit, because really, it, you know, it has to be a two-way street. You know, we want clients to feel comfortable and good about what they're choosing, and we also want our clinician to make sure that they feel comfortable and that they feel it's a good fit for their skill set as well. So, you know, I think that those interested in treatment or treatment for their loved ones should be good informed consumers. And if they feel comfortable making an appointment based on what they hear about someone or what they read about someone, that's great. But if they don't and they want to meet with them and just kind of see if it feels like a good fit, that's a reasonable thing.
Yeah. Do the clients have like a case manager assigned to them?
No, we don't.
Okay.
We're very case, like, individualized basis. So
okay.
Usually what happens is someone will make an appointment with one of the clinicians, and then that is their treatment provider.
Okay.
Unless for some reason, you know, they meet with someone and they have you know, alternate need that may be met better by someone else, and then they might be seen by somebody else after the intake session. But typically they have one provider and one provider only. It's very difficult, you know, when you're seeking mental health treatment, as you know, to share your story to begin with, but
sure.
Then to share it with more than one person, you know, is that much
right.
more difficult. So
right.
We try not to do that.
I'm not sure I ever asked this of you, but do people come to you when they have dual diagnosis, either alcohol or drugs, plus a mental health issue?
That's a good question. No. Occasionally we do get requests for that, but we don't have substance abuse treatment providers. So typically if someone comes in with a request for treatment and they happen to have a mental health issue that we do specialize in treating, but they also are actively abusing substances, we'll ask them to get substance abuse treatment first, because they won't really be able to benefit from the other treatment and be able to follow it if they're actively abusing substances.
Right.
So we like the substance abuse treated first, and then we'd be happy to see them.
Right. Okay. Is your center's inpatient, outpatient, or both?
We have outpatient centers.
Okay.
So we do outpatient services, and occasionally we do intensive outpatient as well. So if someone is pretty severe, for example, and they have OCD and they need to be seen more than once a week, perhaps they need to be seen 2, 3, sometimes 4 times a week, we can accommodate that as well. But we're an outpatient services center.
Okay. I know this is, I shouldn't even ask it because, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Is there an average length of time for treatments? I mean, is it, I know it depends on the individual that I'm aware of, and it is, depends on the severity of their problem, but is there a, like, do you establish a time limit that, you know, we can see the person for 10 weeks or 6 weeks or whatever a case may be?
We don't actually establish any time
okay.
limits. What we do is to continually assess their progress. So, you know, usually we'll take some kind of symptom measure at the beginning of treatment to see where they are. And then maybe 4 or 6 weeks later, we'll take another to see how they're doing, if they're progressing. They're improving areas that still need to be worked on. So we constantly monitor. We'll, again, do it again in 4 to 6 weeks or so.
Okay.
So we're constantly monitoring how things are going. I mean, typically speaking, cognitive behavioral therapy in general, if we have to generalize, you know, it's meant to be a shorter-term treatment, so something like cognitive behavioral therapy for one of the anxiety disorders or for one of these OC spectrum disorders, usually, you know, 4 to 6 months is probably average. But we do have people longer than that. We certainly have seen more complicated cases that are more like, you know, 6 months to a year.
Sure.
Occasional cases that are longer than that. But it's really meant to be a shorter term, let's make you function the best we can and teach you how to manage that on your own sooner rather than later.
Right, right. Does your both your centers treat the same disorders, or do they specialize?
Yeah, we do. We all treat the anxiety disorders and the obsessive compulsive spectrum. We also do psychological testing, different kinds of evaluative work. But yeah, we both centers function with the same area of expertise.
Okay, we have about, I want to say, 4 or 5 minutes left. Is there anything that you would like to bring up? I know I don't want to put you on a spot, but, you know, is there anything, you know, and I'm really not trying to put you on a spot, but if there is anything that you'd like to mention or anything that you have coming up in the near future or that you're working on.
Absolutely.
Or something like that.
Yes. I think, you know, this radio show is a fabulous way to bring about awareness. I think the more we get comfortable in talking about mental health, the more people feel comfortable in talking about mental health,
right.
And, you know, the more available treatment services become, the more resources come to availability and are able to be accessed more easily. A couple of things that I'm involved with that I encourage people to get involved with if it feels like a good fit for them is there is an organization called OCD New Jersey. It is the New Jersey nonprofit affiliate of the International OCD Foundation, which is the nonprofit international advocacy organization for OCD. The New Jersey affiliate has quarterly meetings. It doesn't cost any money to go to these quarterly meetings. It doesn't cost any money to belong to OCD New Jersey. You can get on their mailing list. There's a website, ocdnewjersey.org. Every quarterly meeting has a guest speaker, and we get really fabulous guest speakers that give great talks on understanding OCD and OCD-related disorders and treatment. We also have an annual conference. The annual conference always has some nationally known speaker who's just really great and gives a day-long seminar, and there's usually a lunch as well. So OCD New Jersey is a really great organization. I encourage people to get involved. And if anybody knows anything about trichotillomania or has a loved one or has trichotillomania or skin picking or one of those body-focused repetitive behaviors, there's another organization called the Trichotillomania Learning Center, TLC. The website is trich.org, T-R-I-C-H.org. And the TLC is the national advocacy organization for those body-focused repetitive behaviors. Really great organization. They're actually having an awareness walk. 100% of the proceeds actually go to the National Foundation in order to help raise money for advocacy and for research. And that walk is being held this Saturday in Pensauken,
right.
New Jersey. It's $25 to walk, and 100% of it goes to the advocacy organization, and anybody can join us.
That's wonderful. The OCD organization you mentioned first, where are their meetings held?
Quarterly meetings for OCD New Jersey are typically held in East Brunswick, so they're sort of central New Jersey. Very easy.
I used to work in East Brunswick, that's why, you know. Yeah, I used to work in East Brunswick, so I know it pretty well. But I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you there.
Yeah, it's fine.
It's held in East Brunswick, and the quarterly meetings are?
Yep, the quarterly meetings are held in East Brunswick, and the annual conference is typically somewhere a little bit further north of there.
Okay. Does your centers take insurance or Medicare or Medicaid or whatever?
We don't take Medicare or Medicaid. We're non-participating, but okay. We do take some insurance. We take Aetna insurance. We don't take other health insurance plans, but if people are out-of-network, they can use their out-of-network benefits to submit claims for reimbursement to see us. Sometimes there are different kinds of agreements that can be made with organizations in order to see specialists. So oftentimes people seek agreements with their insurance companies to access treatment.
Right. Would you give the website and or a phone number if you'd like, in case anybody is interested in getting a hold of you? They could do that?
Sure. Our website is www.thecenterforemotionalhealth.com, and our phone number is 856-220-9672.
And one more time, just in case they're still writing. Yeah.
Sure. It's www.thecenterforemotionalhealth.com, all written out, just like that.
Okay.
And the phone number is 856-220-9672.
Well, Dr. Marla Diebler, I couldn't thank you enough. I really appreciate all you do and all you're involved in, and I appreciate that you take the time to spend a little time with me. Like you said, getting the awareness out. You know, people have these illnesses, and some of them don't know where to go or who to turn to. And, you know, a lot of times, unfortunately, their family isn't a big help either. And they'll tell them, get over it, pull yourself together, you know, yada, yada. And so when organizations like you have, it's just wonderful. And I really want to thank you. And I promise you, I'm going to ask you to come back again. So until then, I hope you have a good summer and enjoy. And we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks so much. Always a pleasure.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. Bye-bye now.
USA Headline News. I'm Kelly Sloan. Joyce Mitchell, the woman accused of helping two killers escape from a New York prison, appeared in court today. She allegedly gave David Sweat and Richard Matt contraband, which they used to escape. She pleaded not guilty, but Clinton County District Attorney Andrew Wiley says additional charges may be added.
It's potential that there'll be additional criminal charges involving Ms. Mitchell, but at this point in time, those issues are all still being investigated.
He also said the manhunt is costing about $1 million a day. Jeb Bush is set to launch his presidential campaign this afternoon. The former Florida governor is expected to downplay his surname and focus on his experience. He released a web video earlier.
So many people could do so much better if we fixed a few things. My core beliefs start with the premise that the most vulnerable in our society should be in the front of the line, not the back.
He will deliver his speech at Miami-Dade College. This is USA Headline News.
Dentist office, may I help you?
Hi, I'd like to cancel my teeth whitening appointment.
Oh, may I ask why?
I found a teeth whitener that works in 5 minutes that I can do from home.
Can I ask what it is?
It's called Power Swabs, and it whitens your teeth in 5 minutes, doesn't leave my teeth feeling sensitive, and it's a lot less expensive than visiting the dentist.
Hi, I'm John Greenhut, the CEO of Power Swabs, and if you want to whiten your teeth 2 shades in 5 minutes and 6 shades in 7 days, then try Power Swabs. There's no messy strips or trays that you'll have to leave in your mouth for an hour. Just swab your teeth and you're done. It removes stains on natural teeth as well as caps and veneers. Try Power Swabs risk-free by calling 1-800-270-8863. That's 1-800-270-8863. I guarantee your friends and co-workers will be wowed by your new white smile. Try it risk-free and get free shipping and handling today. Dial 1-800-270-8863. That's 1-800-270-8863.
Democratic presidential contender Hillary Clinton is campaigning today in New Hampshire, and she says if elected, one of her first proposals will be to help parents with child care.
I will work with states and communities across America to make sure that in the next 10 years, every four-year-old in America has access to high-quality preschool.
She says she will double federal funds and grants for Head Start programs. The president of the NAACP in Spokane has resigned amid questions about whether she lied about her racial identity. The parents of of Rachel Dolezal have said she has falsely portrayed herself as black for years, even though she's actually white. Chapter member Kitiara Johnson, who led the petition asking